This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
This is Indie Book Publishing, brought to you by Balboa Press. My name is Brian Houston. Today we are talking with a lady who has quite the story, came from a very privileged background, and then went on to completely change her life by making a move, finding the love of her life in a most remarkable way. The name of the book is The Kahuna and I, A Remarkable True Hawaiian Story. It is written by Victoria Kapuni. And we are with her right now on the telephone from her home in Hawaii. Ms. Kapuni, how are you?
I'm fine, Brian.
Thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us today about your book. First of all, I want to find out a little bit about you. Tell us about Victoria Kapuni.
Well, you kind of hit on that high point of privileged life. I was a Philadelphia debutante and a DAR, and I moved to Hawaii in 1969 or 1996.
Okay, how old were you then?
You're not supposed to ask those questions.
Oh, well, I thought maybe you might have been like 20 years old when that happened.
No.
Okay.
I lost my mother, and I divorced a third time, and I decided to move to Hawaii, bought a one-way ticket, and came over here. But the important thing before that was my quantum spiritual growth with Black Raven, who was a Zuni medicine man. I met him in the making of what I call spirit vessels, and he oversaw me in visions and helped me through some difficult times, because I was doing this growth. And when this happens to you, you feel like you are going crazy, maybe, until somebody is there. And he was there for me. And so I feel like my book is helping other people get through this leap of getting into a spiritual life and a spiritual world.
Now, how did you come to meet this mentor?
I really never met him.
Okay.
He and my husband knew each other, and so he was not talking to me because I was a woman, and he just did it mentally. And then he would talk with my husband when I was in trouble and tell my husband what to do.
Okay. I could see where people would think, or you might start thinking, you're going crazy. That had to be quite an experience.
Yeah. Yes, it was. It definitely was. The vessels were very important. They were from the fifth dimension, and I made them with rolled slabs. I rolled the slabs of clay out and layered them on top of each other between plastic and carried them much like children. I called them my children. And when I brought them home to make them, there was only one way they would go together, and they happened to be on top of each other. The one beneath it would go with the one atop of it. So then these vessels were interesting in that they had faces on them.
Faces?
Faces. They started out to be Indian faces. I'd never sculpted before, and I just put faces on them. When I sold them in four states at many shows, and the people would recognize their piece. They would come and yell, or they would come up to them and cry, or they would just come up to them. And they would sell in the order. This was what was interesting, in the order that I made them. So that was the vessels, and that was a spiritual quantum that I made. in seeing them and having Black Raven see them and help me along the way. Then I moved to Hawaii and met Bill, my husband, my fourth husband, who was the love of my life. He was actually an event. Because the man was a kahuna, and he was 6'4 and 300 pounds. He
wow.
was just a mountain of a man, and he had such spirit, mana, we call it, mana, which is the life force that flows through all living creatures, men and animals and trees. This mana is the power of God. It's what I say you look inside yourself to find, to be awakened, and when you find God, you find yourself. And that goes to the part of the spiritual awakening that I wanted to discuss. There's four things that I want to help people with, because you probably already have some of them. You have noticed someone in your thinking, and all of a sudden you end up seeing them in the store, or you end up getting a letter from them. I believe this means that you are connected to the spirit world when you experience this. It is as if we're all in one big pot of stew, and God stirs the stew up, and you being a carrot are all of a sudden moved to the potato which you were thinking of. And that's how that spirituality works. The other thing is deja vu, which many people have. This is an experience that you have experienced things happening or people saying things moments before, and instantaneously you know what is going to happen. So when this occurs, we're beginning to open the psychic awareness of what I call life force, or this flow of spirit that I just talked about, the mana in the people, because I believe it is a connection between the difference in the concept of time in this physical world and the no time of the spirit world. The third way you can awaken is to have prophetic dreams, which I began to have. They allowed me to cope with things that would be happening in the future, a kind of heads up or a warning, so that when it happened, I wouldn't be so shocked or caught off guard. For example, when I failed the bar by one point, I visualized in my dream that I was walking to the mailbox and opening the mail and walking up to that surprise letter. Or in a car accident that my son had when he was 16, I had the screaming nightmare, and it was all black, and then there was a flash of light like in the comic books, and then the next time I had the dream, it went a little further until the third time I had the dream, he was driving. So then I had an experience with my husband, with his operation. I figured out that it only happened when it happened three times in a row. It was important, and it was going to happen, and less than that wasn't. So when I had this operation about my husband, I had him, he was hanging like a piece of meat twisting on a sort of like a hook, and as he turned around, there was a red line that went down his back, and there was a red ball at the end of it, and I didn't know what that meant at all. And I had it two times, and I didn't have it the third time, but the third time, the doctor changed the operation day, and so it wasn't going to be on the same day. And when he came out of the operation, he had a red tube that was filled with blood coming out of his neck and came to a ball of blood in the ball. So these were dreams that were helping me cope with what was going to happen. Another one happened with being married to Bill in the Lao Point fight against the Singapore conglomerate that was going to develop 200 acres of pristine Molokai land that was in the southwest corner of the island. And I was flying over the beach, and I didn't recognize the beach at all. I was flying over the beach in my dream, and I saw this beautiful beach, and two times I saw it. I didn't see it a third time, so it wasn't going to happen. It wasn't set. So I went and fought. We fought it. I ended up writing 4,912 environmental impacts questions for their hearing, and they threw in the towel with that. But the fourth way a person can become awakened is by becoming one with nature. Nature is what God created, and to become one with it is to become with God. I remember doing this the first time when I was river running, and I would focus on the river. The river was so intense that there was no time. All there was the river. The river was rushing, and it was the Grand Canyon. So it's not just a lazy little river, it's a ferocious river. And that was when I became first involved with becoming one with nature, or having a mystical experience. You move yourself into a spiritual realm where there is no time or space. It is a mystical experience where you merge with nature and lose yourself. There's nothing but you and the object or nature. So those are the four ways that people can become awakened. Bill had remarkable powers of concentration and healing and abstractions of thought, all gifts obtained by keeping near to nature, because nature keeps the human spirit sensitive to impressions not commonly felt by most, and keeps one in connection with unseen powers. When you are in the now, or in that focus with the intensity of the river, for example, you are in the present. The past and future merge into the now, and you can heal. You are with spirit, and you can heal that way. I'm sorry I got off on...
No.
I got talking.
No problem. What caused you to write the book, The Kahuna and I, a remarkable true Hawaiian story?
Okay. That was a 3 months into Bill's death. I was spending another day sitting looking at the ocean out the windows, and something made me go into the bedroom and look at the computer. I turned the computer on. I hadn't turned it on since he died, and all I've been doing is drinking Coke and eating cake, sitting there day after day. And I saw on the computer Victoria's story. Not Sony, like it really says, but story.
Mm-hmm.
And so I shut it off and went out again, and a couple days later I came back and turned it on again, and there it was, Victoria's story. And I went back into the living room and I said, that's what I'll do. I'll write a story about how this woman starts as a Philadelphia debutante, travels 4,000 miles, and gets to the little island of Molokai that has 7,300 people on it, and marries a kahuna and lives in the middle of Hawaiian homestead lands, surrounded by Hawaiians. And that's what I decided to do. How did I end up there? It was just a puzzlement to me before I started writing, and then I saw where each twist and turn in my life led me to the next step, where I continued my journey to Bill.
What is one thing I mean, you've already covered a lot of information here, but what is one thing you want your readers to learn or take away from this book after they've put it down, finished it?
Okay. The most important thing, I think, that I have to say is that we are all great spiritual beings. We have to actualize our potential as a spiritual being. And to do that, you need to get into spirit, meditate or pray, what's your choice, and have a positive attitude. In viewing life differently, with a positive attitude, you experience life differently, and hence you can live life differently.
And you show this through all the experiences that you've already detailed here, just in the way that you ended up in Hawaii with the love of your life and all the experiences that went with that, I guess.
Yes, that was the ending that I was going to end with, to become the great spiritual beings you are. We all have that potential. But there's four things that you have to, I feel, change, give up to get there. And one is giving up controlling anyone, anything. You have no control. You just follow your destiny. The second is, and that is because if you're trying to control something, you're spending a lot of mental energy working on that, and you're not able to live in the now. You just have to enjoy what is here and what is for you now and be happy. The second thing is give up the importance of money. Money is another thing that people focus on, and it debilitates them. It keeps them from living in the now, which is the only place you can be happy. The third thing is live without fear in your life. Be willing to walk directly into life and dissolve directly into fear and dissolve and dissipate it.
Okay.
Bill and I did that because we were athletic and we were strong, and we probably more than most know how to do that. And see, when you're afraid, you're all huddled up in a ball, mm-hmm. and afraid, and you can't live and enjoy the great world that we live in. And the last thing is love is all there is. When you simply stop right there. That's what I did with Bill when he was in front of me for the first time. There was nothing else to compare. There was no other thing over around. My search was over. It's all you need. A life without love is no life at all. The greatest of everything we can know is love. God is love. Love is all there is.
Where can people find your book, The Kahuna and I, A Remarkable True Hawaiian Story?
At Balboa Press, online at Amazon, and I believe at the bookstore.
Barnes & Noble, possibly?
Yes.
Okay, Barnes & Noble. All right. And are there any social media sites? Do you have a website, anything you'd like to promote while we're talking?
I do have a website, although, and I have a Facebook page, although the Facebook, I haven't been working it very mm-hmm. much. The website I have.
Okay, so the website is www.hayhouse.com/The Kahuna and I, A Remarkable True Hawaiian Story, correct?
Yes, I think so.
Fantastic. Mrs. Kapuni, thank you very much for taking the time to tell me about your book. It sounds fascinating, and we hope people will check it out and read it and then contact you and talk to you about what they've learned and experienced from your book.
Yes, I have a lot of people that do that now, and I'm most appreciative for it. I'm very happy that I'm able to get this information to people so they can follow it and have an easier time than I had.
Fantastic. Thank you again for spending some time with us and talking about the book, and we wish you the best of luck with it.
Thank you, Brian.
Yes, ma'am. It's Victoria Kapuni. She is the author of the book, The Kahuna and I, A Remarkable True Hawaiian Story. Again, my name is Brian Houston. Thanks very much for listening to Indie Book Publishing, brought to you by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hi, everybody. This is Pete Dix of Beatles and Beyond. Why don't we all come together and hear some of the tracks off the latest Beatles release on this radio station? Yes, why don't you look up the schedules on this radio station and join me and Beatles listeners everywhere to hear these latest releases from the Beatles on Beatles and Beyond with Pete Dix.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, When Push Comes to Shove, a memoir, and the author is Paul Schauffelin. Paul joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to everyone by Lulu. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Steve. Nice to be on your show.
Well, great to have you with us all the way from Dublin.
That's right.
All the way from Dublin.
So a nice autumn day here today.
Well, here in Texas, it looks like we're going to get some rain, which we always need. But certainly, when we talk about your book, it's not a dreary book. It's a book filled with all kinds of excitement and learning. And my goodness, the way you started out with your very rock-solid family, and you pay tribute to them. But you started from modest beginnings, didn't you?
I did, Steve. You know, I was raised in a small farm on the northwest coast of Ireland in a county called Donegal, and so it's a beautiful place. But you know, it was pretty impoverished in those days. That was the 50s and 60s, and we grew up, I'd say, on a small farm. And my mother was very much the driving force, and she saw the escape from that, if you like, the drudgery of the small farm was. Education, and I mean, that was the thing. She was just ruthless in pursuing that for her two boys, and you know, I was the eldest, and I was fortunate that she was that driving force. So, and she had a sister who worked in New Jersey as a nurse, and she basically funded my college education, and it was a great start. And you know, I certainly have benefited hugely throughout my life from that beginning.
Why was horseback riding important back in those early days?
Well, most people used the horses and indeed the donkey and cart for basic farm transport and for bringing farm goods to the market and with sheep and bringing vegetables and potatoes and all those sort of things. And then you had a horse or a pony, and then the natural thing was to get up on the pony and ride the pony. And we rode, in those days, we rode bareback. And, you know, it gives you a pretty good grinding in horseback riding. But it wasn't as fashionable as it is today. It was seen as just what poor people did. You know, they got up on horses and rode them bareback. But, you know, when I sort of started my work career, I sort of veered a little towards golf, and then I thought golf is very difficult. It takes such a long time. I don't have time because I'm working all week. And I said, well, why don't I do something that I enjoy and that I'm good at? So I went back to horse riding and got a lot of fun out of horse riding. I found it a real, gives you a real adrenaline kick, if you like, horse riding, the sort of horse riding that I did. And I was very fortunate to be able to do that.
Why and how did you get involved in the banking industry? What attracted you to that career?
Well, I worked for the Irish Customs Service. That's the, you know, the manning their borders and all that sort of thing for a little while after school, because it was near where I lived. And then I sort of started saying, well, this is pretty shallow, you know. Really, this must be more to life than this, you know. It was just sort of watching people crossing the border and trying to track down smugglers and this sort of thing. So, you know, I had a cousin in banking, and it kind of looked, my uncle advised me that perhaps I should take a look at banking, and I was fortunate to be able to pass the entrance exam and get in there. Now, it was tough going in the early days, because you were basically, you know, a junior clerk, and you handled the mail room and that sort of thing. You did looked after the post. But, you know, you saw everything going on around you. You could learn, and, you know, there was just, I was a bit of a vacuum for hoovering up, you know, knowledge and experience. And, you know, I was able to build on that and throughout my life. And, you know, it served me well to start at the bottom rather than to go in, like, in the middle or towards the top. So I think many people these days start in the middle. They don't start at the bottom. But I think there are still a lot of advantages if you can manage to start at the bottom and make your way through it.
Well, you started at the bottom, eventually became chief executive of Barclays Bank Ireland. We'll find out more about that in a bit and find out about your views of the banking industry as well. But let's talk about Belfast and the Troubles. That's an interesting title to a chapter. What were the Troubles?
Well, the Troubles were the basically the IRA terror campaign in Northern Ireland, which commenced around 1968. And I was there in the early 70s. And 72 was probably the nadir, if you like, of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And, you know, it was a very vicious terror campaign, and the British Army were there. They were trying to keep law and order, but extremely difficult. And, you know, there was an incident on which was called Bloody Friday in that year. And you know, we all had to. I worked in Belfast that time in the bank, and we said, look, the authorities in the bank said, go home. This is an awful day going to happen here, because there was police warnings about several bombs, you know, there was just sort of buildings erupting all over the place, and it was just a very frightening day. It looked like on the eve of civil war, but thankfully the situation gradually improved, you know. But it was a very difficult time for somebody from Southern Ireland, if you like, which is predominantly Catholic, to be in the sort of, if you like, the citadel of unionism, which Belfast was in those days. It's changed a lot now. It's a lot more equal, and, you know, society works a lot better. But it was a pretty it was a kind of Puritan atmosphere, where shops were closed on Sundays, and I wasn't used to that. So it was a difficult time for a single guy to be in that environment. Having said that, you know, a lot of learning in the bank at the same time.
It's difficult for us who have never been through such an experience of trying to live life day to day and then having all that danger all around. I guess you just kind of go with the flow, huh? I mean, it's...
Well, you go with the flow and you try to keep, you know, everything gets very kind of sectarian, if you like. You got to keep within your own tribe, if you like. You can't sort of cross the lines too much, because it's very dangerous. Even though you know there's great people on either side, and you'd have friends, work friends that would be, you'd see them every day, and you'd be very friendly with them. But you mightn't be able to visit where they lived, or they couldn't visit where you lived. So there was quite a challenge.
And then once you became in the higher leadership of the bank, Barclays Bank, tough times, tough economy, struggling economy, that must have stretched you, really stretched you.
Well, I worked for which was called the Ulster Bank, which was part of the RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland group, at that time. And then Barclays moved into Ireland in the late 70s. So that was a new competitor, if you like. So they were looking for people that knew the market. You know, it was a sort of a fast tracking for me to get to jump a couple of levels by moving to a competitor. albeit in a very tough market, and to trying to build a business from zero, even though the name Barty's was quite a powerful name. So that really did help mitigate a great deal in helping us build a business. And, you know, I was the sort of key, if you like, local person in the Barty's, which was an English-owned bank. And, you know, that was quite fun and quite challenging. Nevertheless, there was lots of internal politics that made life very difficult. You know, one could say that sometimes head office was a bigger challenge than the customers. You know, building the business, having new customers, you know, I was very comfortable with that. But the politics can be quite challenging in big organizations. So that was one lesson I learned, that you got to kind of see how an organization works and see who are the people that can, I feel like, who are the enablers if you want to do something and get things done in an organization. So that was quite a good base learning for later on in my career.
And also having to deal with possible closures. I mean, that is the worst thing to hear, that a bank is going to close.
Well, that's right. And, you know, once competitors sort of get that into their nostrils, that one competitor, another competitor is closing, then they start to be like predators getting in on your customers. So that's a tough time. So, you know, to fight that off is challenging. And then you've got the threat of closure. But, you know, I was very fortunate in being able to meet the challenge of closure. It was a very high-level decision that was taken. But, you know, I kind of fought it all the way, you know, it worked out. I was able to use the politics in my favor, that I had a good understanding of the Barty's organization, and I knew that there was divisions there that might find our business appealing. So we were able to convince them to take over the ownership, if you like, the internal ownership of the business from the division that it was in that really wanted to be out of the business. So it was kind of a new dawn, if you like. Very challenging and very tough. And, I mean, I had better offers to move to other organizations at the time, but, you know, I was drawn to the struggle of staying with Barclays Ireland and it continues even after my time there to be, you know, a very prosperous organization. So that's, you know, I'm very pleased about that, I suppose, and I kind of enjoyed that period.
Well,
on reflection.
Well, with such a long career in the banking industry, I'm sure you have some views about the banking industry today. How do you see it?
Well, I see the banking industry. I mean, I think some of the banks, and particularly in the American, European banks, the large banks have become almost too large, and you know, very, very difficult to manage. And you can see all these write-offs that they're having now. I mean, they're parts of their business that have gone, I feel like, gone off the rails a bit, and they have cost them huge, huge money in terms of annual write-offs. So, you know, you could argue that some of the banks are too big. The other thing that's happening is that the banks are sort of neglecting their kind of utility role in terms of distribution all over a country, and they're forsaking that role, if you like, and getting smaller, getting narrower, and leaving that to the post office and other sort of hedge funds. Even are becoming involved in banking. They see an opportunity now that the banks are vacating. And I think that's a pity. So I think it's going to be quite a few years before the banks that have been sort of hard hit in the financial crisis recover their poise, if you like. Whether they will ever recover the confidence that they enjoyed, which was enormous. I mean, they just had such a cachet about them, but they sort of threw it all away.
Now, you also got to know and worked with some of the country's top business figures. Anything stand out to you that you could share?
Yeah, well, I mean, I sort of, you know, I sort of did business with the people like, I don't know if you've heard of Tony O'Reilly. He was chief executive of the Heinz Group once. He's an Irish guy, and he lived in Pittsburgh for many years. So I did business with him and with his people. And, you know, he was an incredibly sort of charming individual, and almost like sort of Irish royalty, if there's such a thing. But, you know, unfortunately, things have not gone too well for him in recent years. He's just having a bit of a hard time now. But I came across Michael Smurfit, who was part of the Smurfit Kappa Group. He was really the founder of that business. And let me think, a local Irish entrepreneur called Bill Cullen, who had the Renault franchise here, who I was very involved in sort of supporting. And that was a tough deal to do, and you know, I lost a lot of sleep over that one, but you know, it did come right in the end. So you know, I think as you get when you're younger, you tend to sort of be less risk averse. As you get older, you get sort of more risk averse, and you don't maybe do the high energy deals that you might have done when you're in your earlier career. You get wiser, I think. But that's when an organization needs that kind of balance of the younger tigers with the wise old heads. If you can get that blend, it just works so well, you know.
Your book, When Push Comes to Shove, a memoir, it traces your life from modest beginnings to the higher echelons of international banking. You also call your book a happy book. Why do you call it a happy book?
Well, I think, you know, I see it as you know, it's a kind of a glass half full kind of approach. In other words, throughout my life, it was almost like, you know, I didn't pre-plan to sort of end up where I've ended up. And, you know, I kind of just took opportunities when I came to the fork in the highway, if you like. I just was lucky to take the right or left fork, whichever one was the better one. And, you know, it was good. And I really do believe in taking the good bits. I mean, I had tough times as well, and you know, there was many bleak times even from childhood. But having said that, you know, the good times are so so. I mean, it's just wonderful to be able to have good times, and just why not sort of draw on them and just enjoy them, you know.
We've been listening to author Paul Shufflin and his book, When Push Comes to Shove, a memoir. Paul, what's the best way to get your book?
Well, there's two ways of getting it, Steve. One is on, which is the number one way of getting it, is on the Lulu website. And that's the bookstore section of the Lulu website, www.lulu.com. Or Amazon, it's on the Amazon website as well, and very easily accessible on either website.
Thank you so much, Paul, for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Lulu.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Helen Wu was born and raised in San Francisco's Chinatown, and after a very difficult upbringing, fighting depression, abuse, and addictions, she finally finds herself genuinely happy inside and out. Helen believes in taking our positive thinking and doing something positive to achieve a positive outcome. She's here to make a positive difference in your life, to be your game changer, your aha moment mentor. She's ready to help both men and women get into a better place. Helen Wu is also the author of Self-Aid Success Stories, 25 Success Stories from Successful Entrepreneurs. Inspired by Ellen DeGeneres, Helen wants the world to know that just because we find ourselves in a difficult situation doesn't mean we have to stay there. We can aid ourselves to a better life. So join us for Self-Aid Success Stories with Helen Wu, Wednesday nights at 10, 9 central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Sex and Alcohol in Retirement. And the author, Dr. G. Allen Rose. And Dr. Rose joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. And this interview is brought to you by Trafford Publishing. Hello, Doctor.
Hello.
Great to have you with us all the way from London. And this book is got two parts to it. The first part deals with when you set up and ran a clinic in London where couples could choose the sex of their babies. And, of course, that was very controversial at the time. And you'll explain how all of that went and how that was established to have such a clinic in Europe in general, and then part two of your book, you're also talking about drunk driving and different collection of cases that you were that you dealt with, that you were an expert witness. So before we get into that, though, Doctor, tell us a little bit about your background and how this book came about.
Right. Well, I was a chemical pathologist for many years in the health service, and I had retired at 65, and I thought I'd have nothing to do after that. But things turned out very differently. For one thing, I met in the street one day a whole technician of mine who I knew was very good, had done some very good work in my laboratory. And he said, if you're not doing anything, I've got something interesting for you. He told me about this method for choosing the sex of the baby, which had been developed in America. And that time, a paper had appeared describing the results of 800 cases. And I looked through the paper, and it seemed to me to be perfectly satisfactory. I didn't see why we should start in the UK. It was very controversial, because yes, on all sorts of grounds, but it finally got going, and I consulted various learned bodies before I plunged into this, and the results were very interesting. I consulted the British Medical Association, who thought it would increase the abortion rate. I said it was rubbish, it would decrease the abortion rate, because there'd be less unwanted children. And the General Medical Council, which regulates medicine in the UK, said they didn't know what the public will was on this subject, so they couldn't advise me. They gave me no lead whatsoever. I took this to mean they had no objection either. And that proved to be the case. I discussed it with the... I wrote to the Royal College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists. They didn't deign to reply, so I took it they didn't wish to object. So we really had no objectors, serious objectors. So we felt able to go ahead. And the thing that really impressed me about this work was that in the USA, of all countries, which is very litigious, there have been no, apparently, legal cases against the clinics, which I thought was very remarkable. And that encouraged me to go ahead.
Well, that is remarkable. So no legal problems?
Not that I could see. The legal problems would be if we kept sperm overnight on the premises, we had to have a license. We didn't plan to do that. We planned to take the sperm in the morning and inseminate it in the afternoon. It would all be in the afternoon. So it would never be on the premises overnight. And it would always be between wife and partner, preferably the husband, but certainly the partner was long-standing. So there were no objections to that.
Well,
so there were no legal objections to stop the reason why we could be stopped.
So were there any groups that were against you?
Yes. But there were. But on the whole, they didn't have serious objections that I could take it seriously. Some of them said it would increase the abortion rate, like the business said. I explained that was not so. Some said it would distort the balance of males and females in the population. And I said that would not be so if we were limited to small groups, small percentages of the population. And there were those who said they couldn't really put their finger on it, but they had a gut feeling it was wrong. And I couldn't argue with gut feelings. I could only argue with the facts, the objections were solidly presented. And none of them really were.
So how did the government, the British government, like the House of Commons, how did they respond?
Well, there was a group of MPs in Parliament who did violently object. And they had debate in what we call an early day motion one day to discuss whether Martinic and Baltic should be banned. Glenda Jackson spoke very eloquently on the subject in support of the clinic. And in fact, it was... the objectors were turned down by a considerable majority. So after that early day motion, there was very little objections left that could be made.
You did have, though, you did have self-imposed, as you called them, self-imposed ethical guidelines. Now explain some of those.
Well, the guidelines were, we always explained these to the press. We never published them. We said we would not treat the first child, because we didn't want to pay the balance of the population in the first children. He said, then we would only treat to balance the sex of the family. So if a man had 5 boys, and he was another boy, we wouldn't treat him. If he had 5 boys and was a girl, we would treat him. And we always had the insemination done by a trained nurse, and there's guidelines such as that. And this reassured quite a lot of the patients.
How long did the clinic, the London Gender Clinic, how long was it open?
Well, let me see, we opened around about 1991. I retired from the health service in 1990. I think we opened this about the end of 1991, or possibly early 1992. We ran for about 4 or 5 months. Now, Peter Liu, who is my associate in this, he was born in Hong Kong. He came to the UK at the age of 3 and had all his education in this country. And he said he had relatives in Hong Kong. He would very much like to have me clinic in Hong Kong, and would I accompany him there to do so. So I said I would do it for up to four months. So we opened a similar clinic in Hong Kong. We couldn't be in 2 places at once, so we closed the London Gender Clinic for a period. And he came back and reopened it. What supported it, mainly what publicity does, we were front page news in all the newspapers. I was interviewed on the radio, first item of news and so on, which is a great deal of publicity. And as a result of that, the telephone didn't stop ringing for months. The book dropped completely. And it guaranteed financial success. Very strange. That's how things work. The more publicity you get, the better. We had such a volume of publicity, we could never have paid for it if we wanted to. It was all free. And that guaranteed that the clinic would continue as long as the publicity did. Well, after a few years, the press lost interest, and they moved out into other things like cloning and so on.
Right.
And then the supply of patients dried up. And we decided quite honestly to pack it in. We weren't getting enough to justify the expense. So it ran for a few years.
Well, the second part of your book deals with your experiences as an expert witness in drunk driving cases. Tell us how that came about. You decided to write the book, and give us an example of some of the cases that you have shared in your book.
Well, I was a chemical pathologist, which is a kind of consultant I don't think you have in the USA. And we do have in the UK, not many of them, but there are some of us. And I went part-time for a bit and bought a share in a private laboratory, which had just started analysing blood motorists by gas chromatography, a very good method for analysis. So I got involved that way, and I took charge of that section of the laboratory. And sometimes, occasionally, I was asked to go to court to express an opinion on some matter. And this gradually grew. When I retired, it grew enormously, to my surprise. And so I kept doing it. I found it very interesting. I had certain firsts. First of all, I think I was the first person to describe reflux as a cause of falsely high blood alcohol reading, breath alcohol reading. That's reflux from the stomach into the mouth. Just before he blows into the machine, the gas analysis, the breath analysis machine. And that clearly will give a very high result. And that was taken on board and accepted as a method for explaining a high breath alcohol that hadn't been expected by the driver. And one of the other interesting cases, there's something called the autobrewery syndrome. In this condition, the patient loses his normal intestinal bacteria and is replaced by yeast. This is a result of long treatment with antibiotics. Sterilizes the gut, and the flora is replaced by yeast. Now, yeast does what it always does. When it comes into contact with glucose, it makes alcohol. Therefore, the patient can have a high breath alcohol, not use alcohol he drank. And I did bring one case to court and successfully defended on those grounds. The judge didn't like it, but he had to agree in the end that there was any possible explanation. We tested him by giving him, first of all, a dose of alcohol to see how he handled it. Then we gave him glucose, and we watched his blood and breath alcohol go up and up and up and up to an impossibly high level. And he was degenerating alcohol in his intestinal tract. And this happened to him when he found that he was driving. That's a very interesting condition. There's only one case which I succeeded in proving. So there must be others about. And there are difficulties in getting the evidence. So there are probably more cases about that we hadn't detected. So there are interested cases such as this, which are first, and one or two others. But can you have, if you're in a alcohol-saturated room, as was one of my drivers, he was testing a new way of making balloons steal themselves. He was using alcohol, and he was in an attic with very little ventilation, and he was inhaling this stuff, and he got above the limit, and then went out for a drive and got arrested for drink driving, and he got off. Now, people say, well, should he get off? If you're above the legal limit, that is true. If you're above the legal limit to no cause that you could identify or expect, it's hardly fair that he should lose his license. So I had no qualms about this. But I have to say that the majority of cases plead guilty. They know they've been drinking and they plead guilty. A small proportion will fight against it, and a small proportion of that small proportion will succeed. It's not easy to get off. You have to have very good evidence. There's the another example is where an accident occurs. The driver walks home to his house because it's not far away. His wife greets him and you look rather miserable. Have a drink. And he has a drink. And then the police arrive. And the question is, did that drink put him over the limit, or would he have been over the limit anyway? Then I have to very carefully calculate how much alcohol he drank, what effect it would have had on his alcohol level, and whether that would be responsible for him seeing over the limit. That's quite an interesting study.
Very, very interesting, Dr. Rose. And these cases, you focus on a number of them in your book, Sex and Alcohol in Retirement. The first part of the book, as you've described, is the clinic that you helped found, the London Gender Clinic for enabling couples to choose the sex of their babies. And then part two, you deal with your experiences as an expert witness in drunk driving cases. What's the best way to get your book, Dr. Rose?
Well, you can get it from... You can get it through the big bookseller, Amazon. You can get it from them. You can get it from Trafford, the book publisher. There are two ways. There are ways to write to me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on our show, Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you very much for asking me.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Trafford Publishing.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.